Hello everybody, this is Clint Locklear with Trapping Radio, and I have somebody that I used to pray would show up at some fur sales when I was younger. We've got Terry. Why don't you go and introduce yourself?
My name's Terry Manley. I've been a fur dealer for about 40 years. Trapper when I was a kid. Root buyer, root digger, fisherman, BSer.
when Jeff told me, he was like, you've got to interview him, and I'm like, well, who is he exactly? And then when I saw you, I was like, that's him.
I had hair back in the day when I used to come to Crossville.
Yeah. But I mean, for guys to know, back then we had like two fur buyers, sometimes three. And I know fur buyers never would get in cahoots before one of these auctions. And I mean, it was like dead obvious. And then you would show up and I mean, they would be shooting you daggers. And then you would start buying fur. You'd be buying fur. That's right. And it made all the fur go up, because if they wanted any, they had to pay at least more than you were willing to pay for it. And just from appreciation factor, back then, that's the only way I made a living. Dude, you are a lifesaver sometimes.
I appreciate that. I try to be fair. I didn't want to work for nothing.
Right.
But I was a trapper. I know the deal, you know. The other dealers didn't really hate me, because they used me too, believe me.
Well, but it was...
But they assumed I didn't come to their auctions.
Right. That was clear.
If I showed up after that and bought their fur, they were pretty happy.
Well, there was another bigger guy that would show up. I mean, he was a big guy, had a great big beard, big beer belly. Y'all were like the only two for like 5 or 6 years that would show up and compete with them.
Joey Brake was my good friend in Tennessee, but I don't remember him having a beard, but he's a big boy. Joey,
maybe
is.
In my mind, I just remember it was a beard. But yeah, did he buy fur?
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet that was him.
He was from more like west of Nashville.
Okay.
From Tennessee. Still buys fur, actually.
Does he really?
Yeah. I kind of got him, Joey, going in the fur business. We're very good friends today. We Facebook and text and talk all the time. We became good friends. He had an uncle that bought fur. Somehow, but I knew he's passed away now. But somehow our paths crossed and we hit it off immediately.
So you're on face. So you're like 32, 33 years old. Times two and a half.
I'm 75 years old.
When did you start doing Facebook?
Maybe 3 years.
Did you find it before then?
I never wanted to. I had a flip phone. But my wife has been my biggest supporter, and she's very smart. I learned to use the computer because in my businesses, which have been, and you know, quite diverse, I had to know how to use a computer. Mm-hmm. So 20 years ago or more, my wife said, get on her. She said, I just want you to play solitaire for a week. Learn to use just the mouse, and before long I'm searching butcher shops to buy hides and doing many things on the computer. My growing up years were a little bit tough, and I ended up in your listeners might or not want to hear that I ended up in a boys' school for about a year and a half, kid on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, got back out, never finished school, joined the Navy, but for 10th grade education I did pretty well in life, but just because as a working man, I mean, that's what you have to do when you don't go to school. I'm not promoting kids not going to school at all. Man,
right,
today
right.
You have to. Back in the 50s, you could survive. I mean, I could even get in the Navy without a high school education. You can't do that today.
Right. You were saying earlier before we got started that you, growing up, you had to learn to hustle to survive.
There were six children, no man in the house. From the time the last one of us was born. My mother never remarried. My dad left. She just did secretarial work. We just took care of ourselves. And the funny thing is, no two of us were very close, like hanging out buddies, like families today, you know.
But so y'all kind of went your own direction.
This is what happened. That's exactly what happened. There was, I've lost three of my siblings now. But there's still three of us kicking pretty hard, and we're actually, my one brother, the closest to me, we're better friends today than we were when we were kids. You know, but we all did. Most of them got an education. I was the wild child. Wow. You know, I was the only one that had that outdoor thing, and without a man to help me, you know. I mean, I had fishing pole hidden in the rocks under the 21st Street Bridge in Newark, Ohio, and on the way home, I'd fish till dark, and my butt was in trouble when I got home, went home for supper, but, you know.
Kind of like the dog that knows it's got to go through the electric wire fence and get shocked. You're yeah, still willing to
I
go
wanted to go fishing. I, you know, I hate to think where I ever got the fishing pole, but I love to do that. I still today don't do a lot of things for financial gain today. I've done well, and but I still love to, like we talked before, I love to forage. I'm in the woods. I put on 8-10 miles a day. My phone tells me how far I've walked, and I love to send it to my daughter that's a hiker, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
if you didn't have a dad to help you, how did you get into foraging for the roots? How did you know? I mean,
I had a friend that I'd go to the library and get books.
Okay.
I had a friend, a buddy, who.
But what made you think of? I mean, I guess
I can't actually say. You know, when you're 13, 14, 15 years old, you're playing cowboys and Indians, and you're in the woods back in that day.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, I mean,
even when I was a kid,
yeah,
we stayed in the woods.
Yes, you played in the woods. Well, we learned, you know, I learned what poke was, you know, and poke salad, and was things because you saw it there. You talked about it, and you know, I can remember going. I haven't read a book in 40 years, but I can remember going to the library, and the first book I ever read was Call of the Wild, Jack London.
Mm-hmm.
Great book about their trapping and rendezvous, and man, I wanted to be a trapper, you know. And at one point in time, there was a very outdoorsy guy in my mother's life for a while. That was the only man. He was never lived in our home, but he brought me a dozen traps from my 13th birthday, and that's I started trapping, and I'd catch a few muskrats. We'd catch raccoon. We'd eat them. I mean, my family would eat the raccoon. We'd clean them, and,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, and I eat it today. You cook it right, it's good.
How do you cook it if you didn't?
Well, the trick is cleaning that, I think. You get a nice fresh one, cut all that fat off of it you can, put it and boil more fat out of it, pour the water off, boil it again.
Well, yeah. I've always heard the glands. There's more glands than we see.
You know, we never knew about glands back in the day, but I've had some black people that buy raccoon meat from me tell me there is a, they call it a muck gland. Mm. I don't know what it is. I just tell them, just bring me some when you cook it up. These guys, and they do. I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, it's mostly black people that eat raccoon, but that doesn't mean it's not fit to eat.
Oh, trust me.
You know?
I'm a big beaver eater.
Yeah. So. I like raccoon better than beaver.
Do you really?
Yeah. I've tried them both. I've ate them both. Yeah, I do.
So you cut all the fat off of
it. You just do everything you can to get the fat out of it. It's just going to be awful greasy, you know. And then it's pretty much, by that time, you've pretty much cooked as far as, you know.
So you're boiling water, yeah. Then you're pouring off the water.
But then you put it up. Well, today, back in that day, we put it in the oven in a baking pan and barbecued it. But today you do it out on a grill, you know. But just barbecued raccoon is good, I'm telling you.
So, I'm going to have to try. I mean, I love eating bobcat.
Just like a guy... today that makes pulled pork, you buy those, back home, Canadian backs, big old tenderloins, and you tear that apart. That's what we did with the raccoon. We didn't have a drumstick, and
right.
You know, we picked it.
Were you putting like sweet potatoes and onions? And stuff?
I think we did it. We tried everything, I think, with it. You know, I mean, I can remember being hungry in my life too, as
right.
a child with six kids and a working mom, and you know, a very little money coming in, and. So
you think your mom would tell you to go fishing?
That's a funny. It was a funny. It was just nobody had that gene but me.
Mm.
The other, my brothers and sisters were bookworms, and maybe they fared better than me in life. I don't think they did, but I think at the time they were certainly easier for my mother to raise. I'll tell you that, because my mother couldn't raise me. That's why I ended up in the boys' school. I mean, it was not her fault. That was, well, it was just the way the world was in 1956, you know, right. Seven, that's all.
Did the gentleman that gave you the traps, did he show you how to use them, or did you have to
figure it out?
A little
bit. He took me to the golf course. We caddied as children, too. That's another way to make money. And we pushed lawnmowers down the street. We did jug a shovel in when it snowed down the street and knocked on doors. You know, kids don't do that today, but do. So, yeah, he took me to the golf course where I caddied. And we found a couple bus rat slides, and that's all I knew. And from there, I just did the best I could on my own. He taught me to mushroom hunt, and I still mushroom hunt today, and I've trained, you know, I did a little trading in mushrooms, and that's actually a good friend of mine's business. It wasn't ever mine, we like to do it, but taught me some outdoorsy, and he took me fishing a few times, but the relationship between him and my mother, I think he died, I think he probably passed away, but I learned from myself. I'd go back to the woods, you find a hole in the ground, set a trap, we'd catch something.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a rabbit, we eat it. You know, I mean, so it didn't matter. I liked to catch rabbits. It was fun. For was it worth much? I mean, even muskrats. So we sold them to the junk dealer there in Newark, Ohio. And he was right downtown. And I always remember there was a house of ill repute right up the street from the junkyard. And I could hear him say today, don't you boys take that money up at Leola's now and spend it.
House of ill repute. Okay, I got you. Okay.
That was it was of course a joke. We, the 13, 14 year old boy, he'd go to the cat house, but I still remember hearing him say that.
But, y'all probably talk about it, but everybody's too scared to ever attempt it.
Well, that's probably some truth to that, you know. And today I love the kids that trap. I mean, I never bought a cotton mink from a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would never. I can remember the first time. I still remember the first mink I caught. I would have been very disappointed if somebody told me it was a cotton mink. But I'm pretty sure it wasn't. But as you know,
do you remember what you got for your first fur?
Actually, muskrats were. That's just $1,955 now, but muskrats were over $1. But coon weren't. Coon were like 75 cents maybe for a big raccoon. And we didn't know. And we didn't know how to take care of fur, even skin it at the time. I mean, that came later on.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I was an adult when I through my years of troubled teenager and in the service, there was no trapping. But then when I got out, I walked through a hardware store one time, and I was married now. And they had traps for sale. I told my wife, I'm going to buy a dozen traps. I want to trap. I trapped when I was a kid, and I want to trap. I'm probably, or you know, now I'm in my early 20s. And I've trapped ever since. So
I'm trying to think in my mind. I study economy stuff a lot. I'm thinking $1,955 up pulling my smartphone is probably worth about $8 or $9 today.
Actually,
purchase value. That's probably pretty good.
Hey, you're doing a lot with a dollar.
I remember that when I was a kid, and I'm only like 2 years younger than you.
I'm surprised. I would have said you were younger than 48.
48.
I know that.
But I remember, I would, somebody give you a dollar, you could go to a quick shop.
Oh,
you and you'd come out with just a huge bag of stuff.
Or you could take a gal to the skating rink or go to a movie.
I remember the movies were 10 cents and the popcorn was a nickel and that came with a Coke.
You could do a lot with the dollar. You know? I mean, we could, a good example, caddying, we would get $1.50 for 18 holes. That was a 4-hour job.
Mm-hmm.
As we got bigger, we carried double. Of course, we caddied on, didn't have carts at the time. It was built on Indian burial mounds. They said there'll never be carts there, but guess what?
There was.
There are today, because I go back here once in a while. But today, I belong to a country club at home, and I'm still an avid golfer. I give the kid more to wipe my clubs down and put them in my car, which takes 30 seconds. That I got for working 4 hours.
Have you ever told them that?
Oh, I do tell them all the time, you know. But then it's $2,017 against 1950, mid-50s dollars too, you know. So that's
So how did you transfer from that into buying fur? What made you think that
I
that
got
was?
To, I
you sh- sound you sound like someone, to be honest with you, close and dear to my heart. You're a hustler.
I'll answer your question about Furbine in a minute, but I'll go back to this golf course thing now. It got to the point where I'd hustle, I'd pitch coins to a line, I'd play cards, I'd hustle these other caddies out of their money, and they about made me quit caddying that one time, and I finally had to settle down about that, leaving boys alone.
Well, I didn't mean hustle like that.
I know, but I've hustled my whole life, well, any way and every way, probably, you know. Mm-hmm. When I bought that dozen traps as an adult, in my early 20s, I started trapping. I had a neighbor that trapped a little bit too, and he just sold everything to a local fur buyer on a car, because I did too for a little bit, and then I got to buying fur fishing game, or maybe it was hunter trapper trap, I think it was fur fishing game by then, and reading and learning how to, I want to skin my critters, and then that wasn't too much longer than that. I started skinning them, and I'm working a full-time job now. I'm actually a silo builder. I build farm silos and trapping in the winter, and I'm in my mid-20s. And there's a guy at the silo company. It's winter now. The only work is cleaning up equipment, getting ready to go to work next spring. He worked for a fur buyer in a different county, and I said, hey, I want to learn how to put up fur, you know, and he actually, we made a flesh and beam, and I did that out of Fur Fishing Game magazine. Mm-hmm. And set up in my basement, which was an old coal chute, and had me a little fur shed there. And I had a bunch of stuff in the freezer, and I had skinned it, I learned to skin it. He came in there one night, and we started scraping fur with an old draw knife, a little wood draw knife.
Mm-hmm.
And I've still got that draw knife today, we scraped muskrats with it. I still got that little draw knife today. The handles are gone, it's just got the seal where the handles would have fit over still on it. I'll never get rid of it. Somebody will, one of my grandkids or great grandkids will say, this was my grandpa. Hundreds of thousands of muskrats with this thing. And I got pretty good at putting up fur, but later in life that I started shipping fur to the auctions. But I was one of the first guys in our area I figured that part out too. There's more money there now. Mm-hmm. You know. But I worked, in the evenings, they gave me work at the silo company if I wanted it, because they needed it. I was a good silo builder. That's hard work. And guys, you know, they don't want you to go get another job. You won't be back building silos.
You always want to keep good employees.
Yeah. So I had work if I wanted, and I could trap if I wanted, I drive truck for them a little bit, learned to do that. But there was a local fur buyer in the same town of Markle, Indiana, where the silo company was. So I'd run traps in the morning, go work. Some days I work 4 hours, some days I work 8 or 9 hours. I just knew what they wanted, needed to get done by spring, you know, and sell my fur on the way home. And he saw that I was putting up pretty good fur, and he asked me about putting up some fur for him. I said, well, you know, I've got children, and my wife don't want me working, trapping, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning trapping and working and coming home at 10 o'clock at night. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But I had this little coal room where my buddy had showed me how to scrape. I said, if I could take him home and flesh him, this raccoon, that's what he wanted done. He'd get him skinned. He had a kid skin him. I said, I'll flesh him, bring him back to you in the morning, and you can put him on wire. She said, they'd love that. That was fine. They just didn't want to have anybody flesh him.
Do you remember what you first got paid to do that?
It wasn't that bad. It was maybe 75, maybe 50 cents, maybe 75 cents.
And this would have been about 70s?
No, it would have been in the 60s, actually.
60s.
Mm-hmm.
So before the fur boom really started.
Yeah, it would have been in, it was coming. It was coming. Maybe closer to 70. But anyway, I would do 30, 40, whatever. Guy skinned that day, I'd take him home and have dinner with my family, and drink a beer, and go in the basement, got to scrape some coon.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted the fat back, because back then they'd pay you for the fat you scraped off too. So
what did they do with the fat?
The rendering companies wanted that fat. They lanolin. They still want it today, actually. they charge you to come and get it, but they still want it.
Really?
Yes. This is like, I mean,
do you sell coon pat today?
No, they won't pay you for it, but actually, like I said, they'll charge you to come and get it, but it gets used. They render it into, they run that through presses and render it into lanolin.
I learned from Red O'Hearn, in the wintertime, chickens love the coon fat.
How about that?
So you put those out, you come out in the morning, and your coon carcasses look like they've never had an ounce of fat on them.
I still keep, at my shop, I still keep the fat separate. They tell me I don't have to. I say, boys, I know that fat's worth more than the muskrat carcasses. That's the way I do things. If you guys are, you know, you don't have to sort it. I know they use it. Because butchers, later, as we talk, you know, I got into the cattle hide, the deer hide business, and they actually do pay those guys a little bit for their bones and their fat, and they keep everything separate for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As scraping coon for this guy, after a while, these auctions started happening, like you and I talked about, FTA auctions and Trapper Association auctions.
Mm-hmm.
I found out about them, and I thought, well, I'm going to sell my fur at them auctions, you know. instead of to old Kenny Faust, the guy I was scraping coon for, and he was okay with that, but after a while, I didn't scrape coon anymore for him, and some of my buddies were actually having me put up fur for them, and then one thing led to another. I had a chicken house on the property. I converted it into a little bigger fur shed. If my memory serves me right, I'm going to say this chicken house was at the most 12 feet wide and 20 feet long, and I think it wasn't quite that big even.
Mm-hmm.
I turned that into a fur house, and the market price was going up and up in fur. And we would, in that little chicken house, we would do between 5,000 and 10,000 coon a year, and about that many muskrats. I didn't have any cold storage. My cold storage was underneath a rowboat turned upside down outside the fur shed, or anywhere I could put it, you know. And I got broke into a couple of times too, but then I built a bigger shop, and we dealt in deer, got started dealing in deer skins and buying more and more fur. Sold the deer skins to a very good friend that I bought. We could buy several thousand deer skins at that time. His name was Rick Laux, and he had a connection with the New York Tanners, I think, at the time. And he got killed. Rick got killed out chasing hides, actually. The guy he was working with came to see me about picking up the business that Ricky was doing. And I said, I'll try it. Well, I bought some deer hides, more deer hides. I knew where we were getting them, the processors, mm-hmm. you know. And we put up a lot more deer hides. But I didn't really like this guy. I'm not going to say his name because I know I wouldn't
right.
do that. It was okay. He made a little money as long as I made a little money, but I think he wanted to make a little more of me, and I do all the work. And,
right. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of those people in the world.
There's too many. But, you know, we built that deer hide business up into from a few thousand to 60, 70,000. And I'd connected my, I made my own connections. I have very good connections today still in the deer hide business. Along with that,
60,000. That's hard for me to wrap my head around.
Well, I'll tell you, the story will get better, because we started buying, we'd pick up some cattle hides as we went to, you know, and not many. I'd have a stack of cattle hides at the end of deer season, and, you know, I could sell them too. But I found the cattle hide business to look a lot at some point in time. Now we're getting up, we're skipping some years here, but. You know, we're getting up into the 1990s to 2000 now, but I've learned to use a computer. I'm never afraid to knock on a door. I go to your place, I say, Clint, I need this, or I want this. I wasn't too ashamed to go walk in a butcher shop and say, give them a card and say, put my hand out, tell them, look, we buy deer hides, we buy cattle hides, you know. Mm-hmm. And started one route that I would run myself, in Indiana, Ohio area. And over the years, we built that, maybe I was doing 100 a week, and just I'd have somebody waiting to help me salt them when I get in each night. That over a period of 15 years, that 100 a week went to 1,000 a week. I had 5 trucks on the road, 2 with reefers, because the routes got long, and I was no longer running. I might pick up some of the close ones, but business was too big then. You know, I had a salt crew all the time, and I'm out, and I'm still out calling on butchers wanting more. And I did this over a very short period of time without, other than maybe buying a truck that would, because on time, because of zero interest, I never borrowed a nickel to run this business. I took a little business into a multi-million dollar a year business. I never borrowed a penny.
That is awesome.
I'd make a little money, I'd buy a truck. I took these silo builders. The hardest workers in the world are silo builders. I made them guys truck drivers, deer hide salters, you know, truck loaders, because these are, that's tough work. It's, mm-hmm. Salting cow hides isn't much fun, but building silos on days like today and yesterday, it wasn't either, but that's what we did to survive and feed our families. So I know we skipped some years there, but you know, guys, other guys in the business say, Manly, I can't believe what you did. You know, it's amazing. I'm not ashamed to say I'm proud of me too, mm-hmm. what I did. I mean, I think about that. Yep, that's fine if somebody was to brag on me, but I'm pretty proud of what I did too. So, but I know we skipped some years in there, but you know, all this time I bought fur too. Then I hooked up with NAFA in 1992, after the crash in the late 80s. And I've been a collector for them. I'm the oldest collector they have today, but not for long, because I told them that
you're giving it up.
I want to, but Brian's, I don't know if he's going to let me totally, you know, but we'll work out an arrangement. He said, look, we're going to keep you on a coffer somehow. They need somebody to understand the business, to talk with dealers and try to.
Well, I mean, most people, when they think of the NAFA agents, you know, you have a pickup and you take, but you used to go to the actual auctions and buy fur.
I did do that. I bought fur all along. They're not, NAFA was never crazy about their agents buying fur.
Okay, so you weren't buying it for NAFA.
No, I bought it on my own dollars.
Okay.
But at the same time, they sent me out to buy fur with their checkbook, too, from big collections where they knew this guy's got, you know, a dealer's got some fur, let's get that fur, you know. So a little different situation with maybe me than it is with some of the other agents. There's a trust factor in there where if you're buying fur and you're taking my fur to send a NAFA,
right?
Yeah, you can understand what I'm saying. So there's a segment of people that would think just, you know, this guy, he can switch his junk for my fur. But when I went to them auctions, I tried to never buy low grade fur. I still today. If I go buy fur, so there's no question, you know, unless it's a kid that has a few skins to sell. But I've always told anybody that worried about it, I said, I'll show you my paperwork. Mm-hmm. You know, my skins didn't bring any more than yours. Maybe they did because I can buy enough to full lot and limit some of it. But I never, I'm a shrewd businessman. But if I never intentionally just cheated somebody or ripped somebody off, or that just doesn't fit into my category. Mm-hmm. I never did that. So,
well, I mean, to me, like, one of the things of what you're saying is, you know, you're doing the silo building, then you were doing the scraping, then you were buying the fur, then you got the deer hides and the cow hides, and Do you think a lot of that had to do because you had to hustle when you were young?
Absolutely.
And you just continued
absolutely
that on?
I do. Even today at 75 years old, I sold that cattle hide business when it hit the peak, just about 2012. I sold a lot of that business. I had two huge warehouses in Fort Wayne on 3 acres in commercial property. I bought that without loans.
That is so awesome, man.
I bought that property, fixed the one building up, put up another building, and I was rolling, man. I'm telling you, it was, there was competition was getting tough, and a guy that I knew had some pretty deep pockets, and I dealt with him a little bit. He had actually bought a few loads of cattle hides from me. I called him up one day. I just say, hey, I knew he had some interest in not just buying container loads from guys like me making a buck, but maybe making the few bucks I was making too.
Mm-hmm.
I said, come and talk to me, Jeff. His name was Jeff. And with that day, we pretty much struck a deal. He's going to buy me out. I'm going to help you for 6 months, and you're going to pay me this much, and we're going to fair value my trucks and equipment and everything, and I don't need to pay for them all at once either, but, and it just worked out fine, although I think he's a terrible businessman. He's a college graduate with a business degree, but I went broke. I couldn't make it running that business the way he's running it. Maybe he is smarter than me, but I like the guy. I try to help him today yet even. And of course, there was a no-compete clause involved, which that's not over. It's about over, but I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do it again anyway. If I did, I'd do it for him. I'd help him, but, I have helped him, some customers he lost.
That's
helped
an
him
amazing
get back.
Business, I mean, lesson for people to learn. Like, I've never borrowed any money for any of my business. I've had construction business. I've never borrowed any money in the lure business or anything. It's just...
Fortunately, my wife, I lost my first wife at 47 years old to cancer. That was when, and she was, we were rolling into fur business when she passed, and that was right there after the 87 crash. And it was really tough, man, between the losing your wife, and I rarely worked just to see her through this, for about a year and a half. And the fur market's crashing, and I've got $250,000 worth of fur up in Toronto, and I owe the State Bank of Markle $100,000+. I ain't got it. I can't pay it back. I had a little wrestling match with the IRS. We've got resolved all of it, paid everybody. I paid the Markle Bank worked with me. They just rewrite the loan. I pay them a little interest, and we got that actually paid off. 5 years after my wife passed, I met my wife up today. And she's over there in my tent right now.
I met her.
We've been married 21 years, and she had a. The good thing was, she had I had a home on a small lake, free and clear. No, with a note against it. She had a home on a bigger lake, free and clear. She had been widowed also. We sold my place, moved into hers. When I say I never borrowed any money, I'll tell you the truth. I borrowed $4,000 from my wife. I said, I'm going to get back in the fur business and buy some fur. And I was, other than that, I was just surviving. I was doing some landscape work and whatever. About the same time, one of the guys from Napa, well, Hudson Bay then, Steve Gamblin, who had become a friend over the years when we were rolling in the fur business,
mm-hmm.
called me up one day and said, I want to come talk to you. I said, well, come on down, stay at the house. It's just me now, That's just before Diane and I married. And wanted me to become a collector. And that got me started, Then, Diane and I are going together, and we get married. She's got a good job for Johnson & Johnson. She's a mm-hmm. sharp gal. We have a home clear. So it made it easy for me. She mm-hmm. gave me a little bit of a nest egg to get your butt out and go to work, and that's what I want to do. I start over again now, hard mm-hmm. times are over. So, and Hudson Bay Company, now today it's NAFA. I mean, that gave me a basis to grow into other things, the rest of this business, you know. Mm-hmm. They gave me the foot in the door, and we had some awful good years collecting fur for NAFA too when fur was high. I mean, I just went that first year, maybe collected maybe $100,000 worth of fur. I mean, it was tough, like it is today.
Mm-hmm.
There was like 3 years in a row I collected $2 million worth of fur for NAFA.
Mm.
And even just a little bit of commission, that was pretty good paychecks.
I bet it
was. So that gave me money to buy deer skins and money to do everything. And believe me, this company has been very good to me. As you know, there's pros and cons, but everybody's got their favorites. But they're still good to me today. I love the guys. We're all friends. We're family friends. I wanted to do something. They said just get it done. We need fur. We need fur. We need fur. And I turned fur collecting into a more than a pastime, running a few routes. We never ran routes. I got the dealers fired back up after the crash, and NAFA would help them with the little money, and her Hudson Bay, and got them working. And so we started the very first dealer part lot thing where guys could pull their fur and put a little value limit on it. And but today it's tough again. But like I say, they don't owe me anything. I probably owe them more than they owe me, because that was what got me rolling.
I've got a question, and I don't know if you can or will or want to answer this. Since you went through the crash in 87, was, if you could look, have you ever thought back, did you see it coming at all, or is there anything that y'all could have did to cut your risk on that some?
Well, maybe a little. But, you know, New York was still going strong. Nobody really saw this coming. And I know that Black Friday gets the big blame for it, but I'm not sure that it certainly had something. You have a stock market crash like that. I mean, one day, today it would mean nothing. They wouldn't bat an eye to lose 500 or 700 points or whatever we lost that day.
Right.
You know, but definitely had an impact on it. But I'll tell you one thing. I was at the sale in Toronto in the spring of 88. After the crash. They could have sold that fur and didn't.
Because they were still thinking the whole price.
So Hudson Bay Company was still thinking, we're gonna sell that fur for, yeah. But they could have sold most of it. I was at the sale of Watson. I was thinking, just sell that fur. Just sell the fur. And they learned a big lesson, and guess what they've done here now. They sold that fur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Copenhagen was just as bad. The biggest fur auction house in the world, bigger than Hudson's Bay, because of the ranch fur. Put millions and millions of dollars worth of fur in freezers and ran those freezers for a couple of years and took a heavy bloodbath, you know. So, I mean, just...
Was it as sudden? See, I mean, 87, that's when I graduated high school.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we were poor, so the stock market crashing meant absolutely nothing to me.
But there would have been a trickle-down effect that you didn't know. But,
yeah,
right,
because of my age.
Me too. We don't, I don't care. I own a few stocks today, but I didn't.
Right. So, was it kind of like 2008 when the stock market crashed, because the housing bubble is just like, it just took everybody completely off guard?
2008, we've already been through this story. I bounced back, you know. Mm-hmm. I remarried. I got a little boost from my wife. I got to work for the auction company. But 2008, now I'm in the cattle hide and deerskin business, bigger than the fur business. And boy, that if I'd have quit, and I was old enough that many said I should, I wouldn't be here sitting here talking to you today, telling you about any success story.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quit. I kept picking them cattle hides up. If I couldn't pay them, don't give them to the rendering companies. I said, it's not a supply and demand thing in 2008 so much as it is a, it's just, we're just in a financial crisis, you know.
Right.
I mean, that's all it is. And I stayed in the business. And I kept the best customers, you know. And as soon as I saw a little daylight, I'm right back knocking on that same door I knocked on 10 years ago. Look, this thing's turned around. I need highs. I want, you know, the ones that I couldn't run them big routes and stayed in it and rode that horse back up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and this is, we're only talking 9 years ago, and you and I are sitting here talking about, you right. know, about this thing. And everybody in the business admired me for doing it, you know, and we just did it, you know. I did what I could
mm-hmm.
and kept working for NAFA and was making enough money. You know, the fur market had turned back now a little bit. Just in, it was 92 when they talked to me about becoming a collector, and it was 88 when they refused to sell the fur, and after that they couldn't sell it, bits and pieces. But we could see that turning. The Creeks are getting involved. Different than today. I'm not sure that that's going to happen today. I think fashion plays too big a role today.
So you're thinking, what exactly are you thinking?
I'm thinking that it's there's a place for trappers today, but supplement their income? No, probably not. I just don't ever see. I mean, a $10 raccoon. If you get it to a $10 raccoon today, I mean, what's $10 today? You know. It won't, it's not.
Think it was over after 87?
I wondered if it was over, but not really. Not really, because there was still some business. We faced the same thing in 87, 88 as we're facing today. Too many ranch mink.
Mm.
But I don't blame the mink ranchers, because we'd be lost without ranch mink today. That's the fur trade in Asia. Now, that's what those Asian ladies wear, is mink. They just have to curtail the production. I think they're trying to, because I watched the offerings. There's as many, if not more, females being offered than males in the ranch mink business, which tells me they're cutting production.
Right.
If they're pelting out females. So I think it's going to get down, you know. But fashion is too big of an issue today. I just, you know.
Well, see, I see more fur today with my wife, because she looks at those magazines, and she's always showing me pictures of fur.
Certain magazines are very promotional. And my wife and I, we love oldies music, so we go to many concerts, although not as many as we once did, because our oldies groups are dying off.
Mm.
But you go to Chicago, or we were in Toledo here, saw the Flamingos about 2 months ago, great old group back in my day. And we see a lot of fur, you know, in the bigger cities. There's still, I think, there's a place for fur, for wild fur, but there's no limit to how many raccoon these trappers. They can produce too many raccoons, just like they blame the ranchers for too many mink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, yes, there's a lot of difference between 100 million mink, which I think is down to about 80 million worldwide now, and less than a million raccoon. But the people are going to use raccoon. It's very small market, you know, and the coyotes become a wonderful trim, and hopefully they bucked a trend, you know. But I don't see big fur prices again. I don't see, but you know, look out here, we get pictures, several thousand people here this week, you know, that said buying, selling, trading.
I mean, I think we would all like crazy fur prices. But I think what most guys today want is just the consistent good enough.
Yeah, I think so too.
I mean, if you get $18 canes,
they'd like to be able to sell it and have some idea of what it's going to bring.
Right. Yeah.
It's when you just can't sell it, nobody likes that. See, I see this. I bought close to 20,000 raccoon last year, mostly from smaller fur dealers. I tapped into the Western market thinking there's probably more profit, it's a better product.
Mm-hmm.
you know. They cost a little more, thinking they'd be worth a little more. But at any respect, I see it as an opportunity. I'm more of an investor than a fur trader doing these deals. Because I have some money now. I sold my business. I sold my property in Fort Wayne. I and have some money to invest. And fur don't scare me as bad as the stock market does. So
I 100% agree with you on that one.
So I'm not afraid to buy fur. I'll buy fur this winter. I'll aggressively buy some fur. I'd love to go back to the trap. I love the trappers. I mean, I'd love to go back to the trapper auctions, but there's one problem. My wife and I, about 5 years ago, committed to every February in Florida. That's when the best fur auctions are.
Right.
You know, I can't go to Elizabethtown anymore or Crossville.
Well, you gotta take care of her.
Oh, I love my wife. I've been very fortunate. I've had two great wives that love me too and put up with my crap, you know. And my wife's sitting over there in a hot tent. and you can look at her and tell that she didn't grow up sitting in hot tents.
Right.
But she's right there, right by my side, you know.
So do you buy ginseng?
Yes, I do. I buy roots. I bought roots back when I was in my little chicken house. I got started hunting roots again, me and one of my buddies. I knew what they were. I actually saw a plant one day. We're out looking at a place to trap. I said, Gus, that's ginseng. And it was a big old plant too, and I dug that root up, and some of my trapper customers dug root, but at that time most guys that dug root had some Kentucky in them. Mm. You know. Then you could take roots to Kentucky and sell them, or somebody out of Ohio come over and buying roots. And today, you can't do that, boy. I mean, I got a good friend in Ohio got in trouble just buying roots, taking them across the state line. You know,
so they have a Lacey Act hooked to them, like a bobcat hound.
Yeah, absolutely,
a
there is, because it's on the because it's federally endangered. It's
not, I did not know that.
Right, ginseng is on the federal fauna and flora endangered list.
Mm.
See, once it gets federal, then it's Lacey, you know. So, and the sad part is, it's easier for these conservation officers or enforcement officers. I have nothing against conservation officers; they're my good friends. But enforcement officers become a little too aggressive in setting these guys up. It's easier for them to bust a dealer than it is a digger. A digger, she's shrewd. He's hiding behind a tree with paint on his face and mm-hmm. camo all over him, and you know. I don't like that part of law enforcement, but it happens. It's just it's what it is. I don't like it any better than I like to see a police car sitting behind a billboard with a radar gun. I don't particularly like that either, unless it's been an area where people are getting killed or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of preying on your fellow man to me.
That's the way I look at it.
That's just the way I feel. Life, you know, life between guys like you and me that grew up like we did, and your thoughts and you feel different than mm-hmm. others, you know, and we value honesty, you know, we value doing the right thing, you know. I get as much out of coming to your auction and seeing those trappers happy as I do about making a few bucks there at the auction, you know. That makes my day.
I know you made mine.
Fulfills my heart. But yeah, we bought roots for a while and bought ginseng. And then they started tightening the laws and the regulations, and there's so much reporting you have to do. You have to take this guy's name and address that you bought, and how many ounces, and what county dug it in. And I didn't really, at the time, know that I wanted to do all of that. I didn't like it all. Mm-hmm.
Felt like he's been a snitch.
We resist change, you know. Mm-hmm. So I didn't buy ginseng for a while. And I'm not sure what got me back into it. Well, I do know what got me back into it. In my NAFA days, at one time I was over Kentucky, all of Indiana, half of Ohio with NAFA as collector. Well, I had the Hoosier Trapper Supply Company at Greenwood working. I made a deal to give them a little money, and you collect fur and I'll come and gather it up. This was all worked out with North American officials. And we were in Kentucky and doing the trapper conventions, and met some people there, Jimmy and Heather Childress, and I did the same with them. I talked to, we got them started hustling a little fur, but it was all through me as the collector. And it's,
well, you've had part of my fur then a lot than I realized.
A lot longer than you might realize. Yeah. And things got better. The market got better. I mean, you know, I said to Brian, can we just make them guys full collectors? And, you know, I've got enough to do now. I'm getting older and I'm working more with dealers. But Jimmy and Heather, they bought ginseng. And we talked about it a little bit, and I want to get my ginseng license. I'm going to start buying ginseng. I think the dust has settled and it's okay. And I said, you guys want to buy some ginseng? They wanted to put up a little trap and supply store and stuff, and I helped them financially do all of that.
They're great people, by the way.
They are. I love Jimmy and Heather. And I won't say it was a financial success for me, but it wasn't a disaster either. If it helped them, I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certainly no hard feelings. You know, so we bought ginseng. They bought the ginseng. I bought a little bit, but they bought ginseng. Well, we went to sell that ginseng. At the end of the season, we were going to split the profits. They pay me back what money I put in, we're going to split the profits. And I ran into a guy that I knew had one time been a fur trader and had been always been a root buyer for more than ginseng. He bought root for pharmaceuticals and medicinals, mm-hmm. and places like the GNC stores and things like that. Ran into him as we're selling this ginseng. We're looking at each other, and I know you and you know me, but we're in another man's business. He's there to buy ginseng. I'm there to sell ginseng. Finally, I told Heather, she was with me. I said, what's going on here? I'm going to talk to this guy. And we knew each immediately when we knew each other. And the next year I hooked up with him, and he's got a big business in the Carolinas. And I started more and more aggressively buying ginseng. There's not a lot of ginseng in northern Indiana, but it's very good quality.
Mm.
And they don't buy anymore in Kentucky, but I carry a Kentucky license and an Ohio license, so I can deal mostly in that root business too. I like my local customers, but it's easier to deal with dealers than it is with diggers sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a few good loyal dealers that I buy roots from, and I don't buy a lot of roots. Maybe compared to like the people in southern Indiana, there's so much woods and forest there, you know. Some of them guys will buy 1,000 or more pounds of ginseng. That's a lot of ginseng.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy that much, maybe half that, you know, altogether. But it's enough for me.
And you can just look at them and tell that they're wood grown or natural grown?
Yeah,
or
absolutely. If you can't, you're in the wrong business, you know.
Well, I mean, I do a lot with plants.
Mm-hmm.
I propagate and do all that stuff. And I've thought about going out and just planting seeds and kind of keeping a map and going back in 20 years or 10 years and see if they're still there and dig them up. I mean, kind of thing.
You can do that. Actually, go back every year, see what's going on, watch them, make sure that, you know, I go on to, there's two nature preserves in my neighborhood. I go on to make sure nobody's digging roots. And the conservation officers know I go in there. And I plant some seed in there. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to dig on a nature reserve. I mean, that's it. But I don't know. I don't want to dig in those roots. I like to go see the stuff grow. I like to mm-hmm. look at it. And I don't dig much today. One thing about digging ginseng. Somewhere you're going to cross a fence you shouldn't. As a dealer with maybe 100 pound of ginseng in my vault or more, I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't risk it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ginseng diggers, they do stick ginseng. You know, they're gonna start requiring licensing and they're gonna start requiring written permission, but they're still not gonna stop it, you know.
you've seen, a ginseng deer is kind of like a coon dog.
It just goes where it wants to go. That coon hunter thinks he's got that dog's got a right to go anywhere it wants to go, and he's got a right to go get his dog, shoot the coon. You know, well, I'm not in that business of busting coon hunters or snitching on ginseng deer. I tell them when they come in, I want to know how much you got, you dug it's this year's root, and what county you dug it in. Don't tell me anything else. I've had people actually come in, my grandma dug this, or my mom dug this and she died, or we dug this last year and just didn't get it in here. I said, you go home and come back and bring me what you dug this year, and I don't want to hear any more stories than that. I'm not going to bust them, but I'm not going to.
So you can't hold ginseng from year to year?
No, I can. Deer can't.
I didn't know that.
3 ounces for personal use. They can do that. But if they don't know that, most people don't know that. And 3 ounces isn't anything anyway. That's not going to do that. There are people out digging ginseng right now. Season's not in. I've had a call already. I'm not going to buy ginseng. You know, it ain't worth it, man. I don't.
Right. Absolutely.
I'm just not going to do it.
Have you ever bought from guys that grow it more commercially? Like,
I buy some root from guys that do what you've said like you'd like to do. Go out, plant it. You leave it alone. Don't fertilize it. Don't water it. Don't do anything to it. Let it become wild. I can still tell that it's woods grown, but I can pretty much sell it as wild. I don't want to certify any ginseng as woods grown because it just won't burn. It's the paper. It's on the paper that goes with the ginseng. It's just, nobody's going to get as much money for it.
Mm.
You know? And also,
you can tell if I plant those seeds in 10 years, dig those, that if it fell off the plant, and it propagated itself.
The ones that fell off the plant and propagated themselves will become wild ginseng.
Okay.
The ginseng you planted, as soon as you for whatever reason, that mother plant, that new plant in that woods, that somebody planted besides nature, it's probably going to grow too fast, too fat, too heavy, too whatever, and it just has a different look.
Okay. I mean, I've seen ginseng where, like when Canada, when ginseng prices started getting high, and they started subsidizing those guys, and they were just like plowing up cornfields and putting the shade cloth and, you know, the plowed ground, and they get really big really fast, and they were worth like 5% of what a wild
right.
one was.
That's,
you know,
that's what happens. Yeah, I won't even touch that kind of root. I don't want it. I have no place to go with it. Strictly cultivated root. Something somebody's planted in their grape arbor and they water it every day, and they, you know, I don't. Those roots just get too big, too bony, just too heavy.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. Yeah. Because I mean, it is a wild.
But you get an eye for it. I mean, it's just like finding ginseng. I take guys out there, and they trip over it, can't find it. They're picking up poison ivy instead.
Do you buy any other roots?
Yeah, I buy anything that I can sell, even if it's a couple bucks a pound. I buy sassafras leaves from leaves. I even have a guy raise me walnut leaves. You know, this guy has a talk show on one of those, has a show on one of those off-the-wall sports channels on cable TV. And so he does it more for his show than from money. But he bring me, last year brought me 70-some pound of mayapple root. You know, just a few bucks a pound. Black cohosh, blue cohosh, blood root, yellow root.
Golden seal?
Golden seal is yellow root.
Okay.
That's, yellow root's the nickname.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Golden Seal's your real name. It's, I mean,
I never thought about selling sassafras leaves. We're covered with them in Tennessee.
Yeah, they're only worth a couple bucks a pound. You got to shuck them when they're green, and dry them. And but they don't. I mean, they weigh up a little bit. But you, if you you could take some kids out, you know.
Just for spending money.
Right. And it doesn't kill the plant, you know. And sassafras has become very invasive anyway, you know. So no, nobody cares if you kill the plant, but, you know, you can sell the root bark, too. You can't sell the root. They want the bark off the root.
Kind of like black cherry.
That's exactly the same thing, but that's a lot of work, too. Most guys won't do it, unless somebody's clearing a fence row or something. You know, there's old foragers and woodsmen that will still do that. Sumac the same way, but I don't mess with much of it. I just, but I dig. I've dug some. I've been out digging cohosh this summer.
Well, let me ask you this. This is off the wall, but have you ever bought ginkgo leaves?
No, I'm not sure that I would know a ginkgo leaf if I saw one. Same way with some of these mushrooms that grow on trees. You know, there's a market for those.
Well, they're all edible at least once.
Yeah, but I don't, some of this stuff, especially, you have to keep fresh. And they're wanting more and more today. The market's wanting fresh ginseng instead of dry ginseng.
Really?
Yes, the Korean market is, which the Koreans are huge. I mean, it's such a smaller country than China, of course, but per capita, they probably use more ginseng than China.
How do you keep that without it molding?
Well, you tell me. I had a Chinese, actually it's a lady, wanted fresh ginseng. I said, I don't know how to keep it. She says, you have carrots in your refrigerator? I said, yeah, I have carrots in my refrigerator.
But they'll only last for a month.
That's about it, you know, that's about it. But I said, look, them carrots are $29 a pound. This ginseng's worth hundreds of dollars a pound, you know. I mean, I don't care if a carrot goes bad. I'm not going to do it. There's a guy in central southern Indiana that deals pretty much in, but I think they come and pick it up every week, you know. But they don't want you to wash it or anything. They just want you to dig it, leave the dirt on it, put it in cooler.
So what is it like? Is it 80% cheaper that way?
It's pretty close, yeah. I think I would say if you're selling I'll just pull some numbers that I had. If you're selling dry ginseng for $500 a pound, probably selling fresh ginseng for between $150 and $200 a pound. There is a little premium because ginseng dries down over 3 to 1.
Okay.
A little bit over 3 to 1, most roots. So if you dig 3 pounds of ginseng, you'll have a little less than a pound when it's dry, in most cases.
So I know. I mean, around home, where I live in Tennessee, there's a bunch of guys that dig just a little bit, and they may sell, you know, 1 pound or a half pound or whatever. But I don't. If there's anybody that really does it, like trying to make a living at it anymore, I don't know about it.
I have some people, not to make a living. Now, there are people that, in southern Indiana that just forage year-round, you know, and will dig whatever they can. But I have customers that, I have a couple man and wife teams that dig every day for a month or so and sell me several pounds during the course of a year, and it's Christmas money or whatever, you know. But I have more people that do, maybe a little sack in once or twice a year that's got 4 ounces or 8 ounces or 2.5 pounds, you know. But just as far as making a living digging wild ginseng, you know, I mean, that's what it costs to live today. You're not making much of a living.
Right, right. Well, is there anything else you'd want to...
Chip?
No, Chip's not in here.
Okay, is there a music stand in there?
You can come look. Is there... Well, there's no way I can edit this.
I don't know what he... It was sitting out here. I can't imagine why he would bring it in, but... Maybe he didn't want to just steal it.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to say to anybody?
I've had a good time talking to you, and I love talking about my trials and tribulations. And
thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Sure, thank you. We had a visitor, but that's okay.
Yeah. What I pulled out of what you said, besides just the journey, is the determination and hustle.
My life has been a journey, believe me. It has been a journey, and not always pleasant. I had some tough years when I was a young boy. I was a street kid, scrapper, you know, but I grew up, got my head out of my butt.
Moved on.
That's what you do. That's what I tell these guys today. Move on.
Well, I appreciate it, Terry. I really do.
All right. My pleasure, man.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.